Chapter 3. Of course, we had talked about the appearance of the little boy at Venice, and his strange altered garb. My companion said they were pale, wretched-looking and dressed quite shabbily. I got out at several stations, and looked at all the carriages. I could not see my little men. From that day to this, I have never set eyes on them. That is all my story. Who were they? What could they be? How can you explain that mystery of the mother giving them up, of the remarkable splendor and elegance of their appearance, while under her care, of their barefooted squalor in Venice, a month afterwards, of their shabby habiliments at Laybach? Had the father gambled away his money, and sold their clothes? How came they to have passed out of the hands of a refined lady as she evidently was, with whom I first saw them, into the charge of quite a common woman like her with whom I saw one of the boys at Venice? Here is but one chapter of the story. Can any man write the next, or that preceding the strange one on which I happened to light? Who knows, the mystery may have some quite simple solution. I saw two children, attired like little princes, taken from their mother and consigned to other care, and a fortnight afterwards, one of them barefooted, and like a beggar. Who will read this riddle of the two children in black? On ribbons. The uncle of the present Sir Louis N. Bonaparte, K.G., and C., inaugurated his reign as emperor over the neighboring nation by establishing an order, to which all citizens of his country, military, naval, and civil, all men most distinguished in science, letters, arts, and commerce were admitted. The emblem of the order was but a piece of ribbon, more or less long or broad, with a toy at the end of it. The Bourbons had toys and ribbons of their own, blue, black, and all colored, and on their return to dominion such good old Tories would naturally have preferred to restore their good old orders of Saint Louis, Saint Esprit, and Saint Michel, but France had taken the ribbon of the Legion of Honor so to her heart that no Bourbon sovereign dared to pluck it thence. In England, until very late days, we have been accustomed rather to pooh-pooh national orders, to vote ribbons and crosses tinsel gewgaws, foolish foreign ornaments, and so forth. It is known how the great Duke de Brest, of whose own coat was plastered with some half-hundred decorations, was averse to the wearing of ribbons, medals, clasps, and the like, by his army. We have all of us read how uncommonly distinguished Lord Castlereagh looked at Vienna, where he was the only gentleman present without any decoration whatever. And the great Duke's theory was, that clasps and ribbons, stars and garters, were good and proper ornaments for himself, for the chief officers of his distinguished army, and for gentlemen of high birth, who might naturally claim to wear a band of garter blue across their waistcoats, but that for common people your plain coat, without stars and ribbons, was the most sensible wear. And no doubt you and I are as happy, as free, as comfortable. We can walk, and dine as well. We can keep the winter's cold out as well, without a star on our coats, as without a feather in our hats. How often we have laughed at the absurd mania of the Americans for dubbing their senators, members of Congress, and states' representatives, honorable. We have a right to call our privy councillors right honorable, our lord's sons honorable, and so forth. But for a nation as numerous, well-educated, strong, rich, civilized, free as our own, to dare to give its distinguished citizens titles of honor, monstrous assumption of low-bred arrogance and parvenu vanity. Our titles are respectable, but theirs absurd. Mr. Jones, of London, a chancellor's son, and a tailor's grandson, is justly honorable, and entitled to be Lord Jones at his noble father's decease. But Mr. Brown, the senator from New York, is a silly upstart for tacking honorable to his name, and our sturdy British good sense laughs at him. Who has not laughed? I have myself, at Honorable Nahum Dodge, Honorable Zeno Scudder, Honorable Hiram Boak, and the rest. A score of such queer names and titles I have smiled at in America. And, mutato nomine? I meet a born idiot, who is a peer and born legislator. This driveling noodle and his descendants through life are your natural superiors and mine, your and my children's superiors. I read of an alderman kneeling and knighted at court. I see a gold stick waddling backwards before majesty in a procession, and if we laugh, don't you suppose the Americans laugh too? Yes, stars, garters, orders, knighthoods, and the like, are folly. Yes, Bobus, citizen and soap boiler, is a good man, and no one laughs at him, or good Mrs. Bobus, as they have their dinner at 1 o'clock. But who will not jeer at Sir Thomas on a melting day, and Lady Bobus, at Margate, eating shrimps in a donkey chaise? Yes, knighthood is absurd. And chivalry an idiotic superstition. And Sir Walter Manny was a zany. And Nelson, with his flaming stars and cordons, splendent upon a day of battle, was a madman. And Murat, with his crosses and orders, at the head of his squadrons charging victorious, was only a crazy mountebank, who had been a tavern waiter, and was puffed up with absurd vanity about his dress and legs. And the men of the French line at Fontenoy, who told Messieurs de Lagarde to fire first, were smirking French dancing masters, and the Black Prince, waiting upon his royal prisoner, was acting an inn masquerade. And chivalry is naught, and honor is humbug, and gentlemanhood is an extinct folly, and ambition is madness, and desire of distinction is criminal vanity, and glory is bosh, and fair fame is idleness, and nothing is true, but two and two, and the color of all the world is drab, and all men are equal, and one man is as tall as another, and one man is as good as another, and a great deal better, as the Irish philosopher said. Is this so? Titles and badges of honor are vanity, and in the American Revolution you have His Excellency General Washington sending back, and with proper spirit sending back, a letter in which he is not addressed as Excellency and General. Titles are abolished, and the American Republic swarms with men claiming and bearing them. You have the French soldier cheered, and happy in his dying agony, and kissing with frantic joy the chief's hand who lays the little cross on the bleeding bosom. At home you have the dukes and earls jobbing and intriguing for the garter, the military knights grumbling at the civil knights of the bath, the little ribbon eager for the collar, the soldiers and seamen from India, and the Crimea marching in procession before the Queen, and receiving from her hands the cross bearing her royal name. And, remember, there are not only the cross wearers, but all the fathers and friends, all the women who have prayed for their absent heroes, Harry's wife, and Tom's mother, and Jack's daughter, and Frank's sweetheart, each of whom wears in her heart of hearts afterwards the badge which son, father, lover, has won by his merit, each of whom is made happy and proud, and is bound to the country by that little bit of ribbon. I have heard, in a lecture about George III, that, at his accession, the king had a mind to establish an order for literary men. It was to have been called the Order of Minerva, I suppose, with an owl for a badge. The knights were to have worn a star of 16 points, and a yellow ribbon, and good old Samuel Johnson was talked of as president, or grand cross, or grand owl, of the society. Now about such an order as this there certainly may be doubts. Consider the claimants, the difficulty of settling their claims, the rows and squabbles amongst the candidates, and the subsequent decision of posterity. Dr. Beatty would have ranked as first poet, and 20 years after the sublime Mr. Haley would, no doubt, have claimed the Grand Cross. Mr. Gibbon would not have been eligible, on account of his dangerous freethinking opinions, and her sex, as well as her republican sentiments, might have interfered with the knighthood of the immortal Mrs. Catherine Macaulay. How Goldsmith would have paraded the ribbon at Madame Cornley's, or the Academy dinner. How Peter Pindar would have railed at it. 50 years later, the noble Scot would have worn the Grand Cross and deserved it, but Gifford would have had it, and Byron, and Shelley, and Hazlitt, and Hunt would have been without it. And had Keats been proposed as officer, how the Tory prince would have yelled with rage and scorn. At the star of Minerva lasted to our present time, but I pause, not because the idea is dazzling, but too awful. Fancy the claimants, and the row about their precedence. Which philosopher shall have the grand cordon? Which the collar? Which the little scrap no bigger than a buttercup? Of the historians A, say, and C, and F, and G, and S, and T, which shall be companion, and which grand owl? Of the poets, who wears, or claims, the largest and brightest star? Of the novelists, there is A, and B, and C, D, and E, star of first magnitude, newly discovered, and F, a magazine of wit, and fair G, and H, and I, and brave old J, and charming K, and L, and M, and N, and O, fair twinklers, and I am puzzled between three P's, Peacock, Miss Pardo, and Paul Pry, and Queechy, and R, and S, and T, mere A fills, and very likely you, O gentle reader, for who has not written his novel nowadays, who has not a claim to the star and straw-colored ribbon, and who shall have the biggest and largest? Fancy the struggle. Fancy the squabble. Fancy the distribution of prizes. Who shall decide on them? Shall it be the sovereign? Shall it be the minister for the time being? And has Lord Palmerston made a deep study of novels? In this matter the late ministry, asterisk to be sure, was better qualified. But even then, grumblers who had not got their canary cordons would have hinted at professional jealousies entering the cabinet, and, the ribbons being awarded, Jack would have scowled at his, because Dick had a broader one, Ned been indignant, because Bob's was as large, Tom would have thrust his into the drawer, and scorned to wear it at all. No, no. The so-called literary world was well rid of Minerva and her yellow ribbon. The great poets would have been indifferent, the little poets jealous, the funny men furious, the philosophers satirical, the historians supercilious, and, finally, the jobs without end. Say, ingenuity and cleverness are to be rewarded by state tokens and prizes, and take for granted the order of Minerva's established who shall have it? A great philosopher? No doubt we cordially salute him, GCM. A great historian? GCM, of course. A great engineer? GCM. A great poet? Received with acclamation, GCM. A great painter? Oh, certainly, G. C. C. M. If a great painter, why not a great novelist? Well, pass, great novelist, G. C. C. M. But if a poetic, a pictorial, a storytelling or music composing artist, why not a singing artist? Why not a basso profondo? Why not a primo tenor? And if a singer, why should not a ballet dancer come bounding on the stage with his cordon, and cut capers to the music of a row of decorated fiddlers? A chemist puts in his claim for having invented a new color, an apothecary for a new pill, the cook for a new sauce, the tailor for a new cut of trousers. We have brought the star of Minerva down from the breast to the pantaloons. Stars and garters. Can we go any farther, or shall we give the shoemaker the yellow ribbon of the order for his sheedy? Asterisk that of Lord Derby, in L859, which included Mr. Disraeli and Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton. When I began this present roundabout excursion, I think I had not quite made up my mind whether we would have an order of all the talents or not. Perhaps I rather had a hankering for a rich ribbon and gorgeous star, in which my family might like to see me at parties, in my best waistcoat. But then the door opens, and there come in, and by the same right to, Sir Alexis Sawyer, Sir Alessandro Tamburini, Sir Agostino Velluti, Sir Antonio Paganini, violinist, Sir Sandy McGuffog, piper to the most noble the Marquis of Farintosh, Sir Elsite Flickflack, premier dancer of H.M. Theatre, Sir Harley Quinn and Sir Joseph Grimaldi from Covent Garden, they have all the yellow ribbon. They are all honorable, and clever, and distinguished artists. Let us elbow through the rooms, make a bow to the lady of the house, Give a nod to Sir George Thrum, who is leading the orchestra, and go and get some champagne and seltzer water from Sir Richard Gunter, who is presiding at the buffet. A national decoration might be well and good. A token awarded by the country to all its benemerentibus. But most gentlemen with Minerva stars would, I think, be inclined to wear very wide breast collars to their coats. Suppose yourself, Brother Penman, decorated with this ribbon, and looking in the glass, would you not laugh? Would not wife and daughters laugh at that canary-colored emblem? But suppose a man, old or young, of figure ever so stout, thin, stumpy, homely, indulging in looking-glass reflections with that hideous ribbon and cross called five. See on his coat, would he not be proud? And his family, would they not be prouder? For your nobleman there is the famous old blue garter and star, and welcome. If I were a marquis, if I had 30-40,000 a year, settle the sum, my dear Alnisher, according to your liking, I should consider myself entitled to my seat in Parliament, and to my garter. The garter belongs to the ornamental classes. Have you seen the new magnificent Pavo Spicifer at the Zoological Gardens, and do you grudge him his jeweled coronet, and the azure splendor of his waistcoat? I like my Lord Mayor to have a gilt coach, my magnificent monarch to be surrounded by magnificent nobles. I huzza respectfully when they pass in procession. It is good for Mr. Briefless, 50 Pump Court, 4th floor, that there should be a Lord Chancellor, with a gold robe and 15,000 a year. It is good for a poor curate, that there should be splendid bishops at Fulham and Lambeth. Their lordships were poor curates once, and have won, so to speak, their ribbon. Is a man who puts into a lottery to be sulky, because he does not win the £20,000 prize? Am I to fall into a rage, and bully my family when I come home, after going to see Chatsworth or Windsor, because we have only two little drawing rooms? Welcome to your garter, my lord, and shame upon him who I mal y pence. So I arrive in my roundabout way near the point towards which I have been trotting ever since we set out. In a voyage to America, some 9 years since, on the 7th or 8th day out from Liverpool, Captain 50 came to dinner at 8 bells as usual, talked a little to the persons right and left of him, and helped the soup with his accustomed politeness. Then he went on deck, and was back in a minute, and operated on the fish, looking rather grave the while. Then he went on deck again, and this time was absent, it may be, 3 or 5 minutes, during which the fish disappeared, and the entrees arrived, and the roast beef. Say 10 minutes passed, I can't tell, after 9 years. Then 50 came down with a pleased and happy countenance this time, and began carving the sirloin colon we have seen the light. He said, "Madam, may I help you to a little gravy, or a little horseradish, or what not? I forget the name of the light, nor does it matter." It was a point off Newfoundland for which he was on the lookout, and so well did the Anada know where she was, that, between soup and beef, the captain had sighted the headland by which his course was lying. And so through storm and darkness, through fog and midnight, the ship had pursued her steady way over the pathless ocean and roaring seas, so surely that the officers who sailed her knew her place within a minute or two, and guided us with a wonderful providence safe on our way. Since the noble Cunard Company has run its ships, but one accident, and that through the error of a pilot, has happened on the line. By this little incident, hourly of course repeated, and trivial to all sea-going people, I own I was immensely moved, and never can think of it, but with a heart full of thanks and awe. We trust our lives to these seamen, and how nobly they fulfill their trust. They are, under heaven, as a providence for us. Whilst we sleep, their untiring watchfulness keeps guard over us. All night through that bell sounds at its season, and tells how our sentinels defend us. It rang when the mason was on fire, and chimed its heroic signal of duty, and courage, and honor. Think of the dangers these seamen undergo for us. The hourly peril and watch, the familiar storm, the dreadful iceberg, The long winter nights, when the decks are as glass, and the sailor has to climb through icicles, to bend the stiff sail on the yard. Think of their courage and their kindnesses in cold, in tempest, in hunger, in wreck. He women and children to the boats, says the captain of the Erkenhead, and, with the troops formed on the deck, and the crew obedient to the word of glorious command, the immortal ship goes down. Read the story of the Arasans. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.